And we had two options coming out of Treasury. One was to immediately, you know, put our thoughts to paper and publish 2-3-4 months after leaving, you know, our ideas on the subject. And that presented two problems. One is remembering where you know things from so that you don't, by mistake, write something down that you're not supposed to know anymore from classified information. But the other was that we really wanted this to be not just kind of two former government employees' pontifications on the matter, but the product of some real academic research. And so instead we decided to take our time and build on our experiences in government and do a really thorough academic research into the issue. And so this is, I'm very proud to say, the product of 18 months of research, a tremendous number of interviews here in Washington, in New York, with international organizations, IMF, World Bank, United Nations, 1267 Committee, 1373, a lot of meetings of the private sector, bankers. We spent a lot of time meeting with compliance officers, who are in many ways people at the front line who are seeing what are the suspicious financial activities that are coming across their desks every day, and not just in this country, but also met with officials and bankers and compliance officers and academics throughout Europe and in the Middle East. And in particular, there were two dedicated trips to the Gulf, where we had actually great success in getting access to officials and others, and that really made this what it is. And I hope you you enjoy it. You know. And I also want to say, also coming out, that you know, Mike and I have been friends for a very, very long time. We've been worked together in many, many different places: FBI, Washington Institute, the Treasury Department. It was a real pleasure to do this this project with Mike. He's a great partner in crime. what we did in the studies, we basically laid out, you know, why does combating terror financing matter? What are some of the evolutionary changes that we've seen, not only in the nature of the terrorist threat, but specifically in the nature of terrorist financing, because this is an ever-changing issue we're trying to tackle. And then what have been some of the efforts to counter terror financing, and what ways have they been successful or fallen short? And then what type of policy recommendations could we recommend, as it happens in terms of when we ended up finishing the study, nicely timed to a new administration. But at any point, this is an ongoing effort, and what can be done to improve this effort, if in fact it is, as we argue, an effective and efficient use of our time and our resources. Now, when we brief some people on the study, we don't need to spend a lot of time on why combating terror financing matters. Those people who are involved in this in government, for example, they see this firsthand on a day-to-day basis. But when we speak outside in the academic community, I was just up in Boston lecturing on this, for example, you often get challenged on, well, really, how successful is this? How important is this? After all, any given terrorist attack doesn't cost a lot of money. There really are no great metrics out there, nor do we even really know what any of these terrorist groups' budgets really are. And so one of the things we tried to lay out is that, in fact, yes, this is a misunderstood area. But first of all, terrorist designations and prosecutions, these public actions, only constitute one broad set of tools in our toolkit, drawing on the expertise of various U.S. government agencies, but they are not, they should not be confused for the sum total of our tools in this tool basket. And so, you know, you can't blame academics, the public, or the press for focusing on those things that are public, because that's what's there for them to wrap their hands around. But the fact of the matter is, this is just one tool or set of tools. It won't always be the most appropriate, and it certainly will not solve your problem. And we've said this, Mike and I and others from this podium, on the terror finance issue, on the Iran sanction issue. This is a tool that will effectively constrict the operating environment. It will make it more difficult for our adversaries to do all the things they need to do to accomplish their illicit activities. But it will not solve your problem. It creates leverage for other types of tools. And we need to pay close attention to when this is going to be the appropriate tool and when not. Financial intelligence, law enforcement activity, diplomatic activity, and no, that is not a dirty or a soft word, technical assistance, efforts to combat the use of cash couriers, all of these are extremely effective tools, and designations, for example, won't always be the right tool for the right circumstance. And so the metrics that we usually see people talk about, how much money has been frozen or how many entities have been designated, completely miss the point. A designation may not be the right tool. And so It's important to focus on the fact that just because we don't have all the answers, we don't know exactly how much of an impact this has had, we don't know exactly how much money they have at their disposal, we do know that it can be effective nonetheless. And the first bullet point to point that out is that terrorists need money. I mean, everybody needs money. To have this event costs money. To send my children to school, believe me, costs money. Terrorists, while it's true that mounting any individual attack costs a relatively small amount of money, the training, equipping, paying operatives, bribing officials, securing materials, promoting their cause, taking care of the families of their members, all of this costs actually a tremendous amount of money. And even when we're talking about small amounts of money, if you can prevent our adversaries from being able to transfer and access funds, even small amounts of money that they require, you can complicate their efforts. And we have seen usually declassified anecdotes in congressional testimony where officials had pointed out the cells in Southeast Asia, for example, had planned an attack, Abu Sayyaf in one instance, and were unable to carry out the attack, a typical attack that would not require a lot of money because they didn't have access to that small amount of money. Forcing our adversaries to abandon formal financial channels in favor of informal transfers, other slower mechanisms, is also extremely efficient and effective at slowing them down and denying them the space in which they want to carry out all their activities. When you consider, for example, some of the material that was seized in Al-Qaeda, the Sinjar documents, for example, we learned that one of Al-Qaeda in Iraq's branches recorded expenditures of over $175,000 over a four-month period in 2007, about half of it specifically to purchase weapons. So sometimes we are talking about sizable amounts of money. And in other instances, we know that from the Sinjar documents again, that Al-Qaeda in Iraq's border emirate spent $727 on food during a two-month period. And while this is interesting because it's not so much money, it does give you great insight into how carefully they spend money and how much attention they give to the money. And there are multiple instances, and we cite them in the report, you'll see them, where Al-Qaeda is very stingy with money. And at one point, bin Laden has to intervene, for example, to get money to a potential hijacker to purchase a visa because the people who were in the finance chain didn't think it was such an important expenditure because they didn't realize that this was for a major operation. One of the most important people out there today, Sheikh Saeed or Mustafa Abu Yazid, today believed to be one of the senior most Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, grew up through the finance and around the time of 9/11 was the head of the finance committee. And so we see the stress that they put on the funds and how, in fact, it can be a useful thing to focus on in terms of enabling them to not have the space to carry out their activities. If you think about the overarching purpose of our counterterror finance efforts, I think that there are three main areas where we have seen over and over again where they have been effective. And in different instances, we'll be trying to accomplish one or more of the following. The first is that this might be one of the only areas in counterterrorism where you can actually have a deterrent effect. Many of the major donors, and we still have a problem with major donors, are financiers, people who have spent their lives building up financial empires. They're not necessarily the types of people who are sending their sons and daughters to become suicide bombers. And when they see that others are having a lot of trouble with their businesses after being designated by the U.S. or by the international community, they'll think twice before getting involved in this type of activity because they do not want to put the financial empires that they've spent their lives building at risk. The second is that this is an extremely effective means of preventive intelligence. One of the things I think everyone has come around to understanding in the post 9/11 era is that while it's extremely important to be able to piece together the puzzle after the fact and post-blast investigations, which, by the way, this has always been a very, very effective tool. Both World Trade Center bombings, for example, this was one of the first pieces of evidence that led investigators to unravel those cases. But in terms of preventing attacks, this is an extremely effective use of intelligence, use of type of information. Any type of information needs to be vetted. Any type of intelligence, which is just more information from classified sources, needs to be vetted. Anytime you have information that comes at any level pre-vetted, that's a bonus. And the fact of the matter is that if a financial transaction in the formal banking sector happened, it happened. And you then need to dig around a little bit to figure out why did it happen and from whom and to where and for what purpose. But it means you have a lead that already has some substance. And there are multiple examples of how this has been useful. The FBI has reported that following the money in this country has enabled authorities to foil attacks abroad. We know that following the money trail was an effective and important part of thwarting the liquid bomb plot at Heathrow in 06. And so using this as a financial intelligence tool is equally important. And I would say that's one of the main themes we were trying to highlight in the first half of the monograph is it's not just freezing money, it's also following the money. Now, there are all these other tools that I mentioned, diplomacy, etc. But really, these two baskets are really important. And because we don't see in the public domain the all the actions and certainly not the full impact of the financial intelligence element, doesn't mean it's not there. Following the financial trail up and downstream, down to sources of funds and up to potential operators is extremely, extremely effective. And third, as I mentioned, this is a very effective disruptive tool. And any time we have an opportunity to disrupt our adversary's efforts to do us harm, that should be taken full advantage of. Even though sometimes there's going to be a cat and mouse game, we can't count the number of times we've shut down a suspected terrorist entity, a business or a charity, and they've opened up under new names. We can follow up on that again, but you're still constricting the operating environment, making it more difficult for them to do all the things they need to do. The fact is that the terrorist threat that we face today has evolved since 9/11, and we touch on that briefly in here just to put the terror financing evolution in context. But basically, the more or less hierarchical al-Qaeda structure that we faced in 2001 has now devolved into a more of a three-tiered threat where we have an al-Qaeda core that may have, as we were being told by authorities in 2004, been on its back foot. But we are now told by authorities that it has regained its equilibrium primarily in the areas in and between Pakistan and Afghanistan. We also have al-Qaeda franchises and affiliated groups, whether it's LIFG or al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then we also have local groups with less direct ties to al-Qaeda. National counterterrorism has determined that almost 300 groups were involved in terrorist attacks in 2006. And this is now what they're calling a form of global insurgency. Like-minded fellow travelers, people with some type of connection to al-Qaeda, more or less, some not at all. But this presents all kinds of different challenges in terms of the evolution of the terrorist financing threat. For example, we see that globalization and technological change has presented opportunities for us, of course, in combating terror financing, but certainly for our adversaries. You know, in 2000, foreign workers sent about $113 billion back to their home countries. By 2006, that figure more than doubled to $255 billion. It gives you a sense of the scale of the international remittance flows and the scale of the flows moving throughout the financial system and how much this is looking for a needle in a haystack. We see new tools, for example, M-payments, where cell phones are utilized to transfer money. We see the use of storage and transfer mechanisms online, such as CashU or eGold. The use of the internet in general provides a cheap, fast, efficient, and relatively secure means of communicating. And we now see that authorities are, I think, appropriately concerned and paying attention to the fact that it could provide a similar tool for the movement and access of funds. And so we've seen senior officials talk about groups of all stripes, and I quote, increasingly will use the internet to obtain logistical and financial support, and that should not surprise. We've also seen a shift from central control within organizations, aware that we are watching the activities of these central organizations, and diverging decision-making down to a local level, whether it's a local group or it is the local element of an international group. A lot of the cells that we've even seen have had connections back to the federally administrated tribal areas in Pakistan are not necessarily getting money from the al-Qaeda core out to the al-Qaeda periphery, as used to be the case, say, before and shortly after 9/11. Consider the July 05 bomb plots. British authorities concluded that those attacks were estimated to have cost less than £8,000 and that there was no foreign funding for those attacks. Most of the money, in fact, came from one member who defaulted on a £10,000 personal loan and overdrew from his multiple bank accounts. On the other hand, we still see that there are efforts by operatives on the ground to reach out to al-Qaeda core. Also in the UK, Ism al-Hindi, who was identified in part by following the money, as Diran Barrow, who was involved in multiple plots, including the plots targeting financial institutions in New York and New Jersey, was found to have sent a very detailed planning memo back to al-Qaeda, outlining a variety of attacks, including a plot to fill limousines with gas canisters and drive them downtown London and blow them up there, and is now serving a 30-year sentence in prison in the UK. His very detailed proposal laid out that the basic plot would cost about £60,000, which he was asking that al-Qaeda Corps provide. But if you wanted to be a little bit more secure in the operation, instead of renting the apartment, we should buy the apartment. That might raise the cost, etc. We're also seeing, however, that there's a lot of petty crime, some small, some brazen. One cell in France netted about €1 million when a member whose job it was to restock ATMs enacted or faked robberies on several of the ATMs he was purportedly stalking. And the State Department, in its multiple reports, have highlighted the criminal activities of a variety of groups. Some we hear about more often, such as al-Qaeda cells in Europe and Hezbollah, but also now increasingly PKK in Europe as well. For a long time after 9/11, there was talk and then not so much about the connection between the drug trade and terrorism, and now this is something that is again getting a tremendous amount of attention. Authorities believe that about 19 of the 43 foreign terrorist organizations are connected to the international drug trade. Some 60% of terrorist organizations are connected in some fashion to the international drug trade, and that really shouldn't surprise because there is just so much money to be made. UN estimates that the international drug trade generates about $322 billion a year in revenue, and you don't actually have to be involved in the production or transshipment of the drugs yourself to play a role in this. There are many other ways get revenue through these streams, including taxing farmers and local cartels, demanding fees for the use of roads. If you think of the situation in Afghanistan today, that's a very, very good example. One of the things we found and grappled with was the current status of the use of charities, which is, of course, a very sensitive issue, not only because charity is giving charity or zakat in particular is one of the pillars of Islam. It's a pillar of American value system, and it's something we want to encourage. It's actually a tremendous benefit to our international diplomatic efforts when we can pair our diplomatic and political efforts with efforts to improve the situations on the ground. But we found that in our interviews, and certainly what officials are talking about publicly, the abuse of charities continues to be a critical, critical problem. The Financial Action Task Force, which is a technocratic body, an international body which works by consensus, issued a report where they, and I quote, made it very clear, the misuse of nonprofit organizations for the financing of terrorism is coming to be recognized as a crucial weak point in the global struggle to stop funding at its source. And this is something that basically within the community of official governments and experts is very much agreed upon. Which when you get into the academic community, there's a lot more discomfort. I mean, consider, for example, British officials in a report that they came out with finding that in a significant proportion of terror finance investigations in 2006 within the UK included analysis of links to charities. The report found that the risk of exploitation of charities is a significant aspect of the terrorist finance threat. And this is something that we are going to have to give a lot more focused attention to, how we stop charities from being susceptible to abuse, on the one hand, while on the other hand, facilitating and enabling what is a religious and, I would say, an American national value as well. One of the other things we're seeing, for example, in this evolution is that as we crack down on charities and other types of things that we paid attention to for a long time, whether it's groups or charities themselves, are instructing donors to fund regional offices directly. Don't go through our headquarters office. We see this in Southeast Asia significantly. We also find that instead of funding investment in specific programs, funding is going to investment in large infrastructure projects, which is not surprising. The larger the project, the better to launder money, the easier to launder money through it. For example, according to government officials and accounts in the media both, in the Philippines, investigators found that terrorist financiers supporting the Abu Sayyaf group and the Raja Suleiman movement both were facilitating the constructions of mosques and schools under the supervision of Mohammed Suger, a Saudi national linked by the Philippine authorities to terrorist financing tied to al-Qaeda. We also saw a significant of attention and an increase in activity in trade-based money laundering, where you don't actually have to have money move at all. You have goods move, and it can be small goods like oil and rice and flour. It can be big goods like cars, for example, in the context of Iraq. As we constrict the operating environment, our adversaries will continue to use the formal financial system simply because it is so fast, it is so efficient, and with the globalized economy getting so big, as I mentioned, in terms of the scope of international remittances, for example, you can still hide activity out in the open. But it's also true that we are forcing them to use less sophisticated means of transfer, which are slower and unreliable. But that does mean that we need to constantly evolve our efforts to be able to have insight into these activities. We don't want to push them so far out of the formal financial system that we lose insight into what they're doing. And I think actually that that's a concern that is maybe a little overblown. One of the things that in my experience government has been very careful about is making sure that we didn't do so much so quickly without realizing what the unintended consequences would be, that we woke up one morning suddenly unable to be aware of what the continued activity was. But so, for example, we find that individuals in the Middle East, for example, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, when they realized that authorities were noticing that money was being transferred through their personal bank accounts, they started moving money through their wives' accounts, their sister-in-laws, their hairdressers' accounts, and that becomes a lot more difficult to track. And aware that we're very focused on this, our adversaries are going to greater lengths to hide their activities. For example, Hezbollah employed all kinds of deceptive means to hide the fact that monies they were seeking were for a variety of their activities, including their militia and terrorist activities. And so they started using Jihad al-Binna, their construction arm, alongside the charitable arms that they've been using for a long time, to hide the nature of the terrorist link to these activities, and would, like Iran has done on the proliferation account, hid from the paperwork any Hezbollah or Iran footprint from financing that might have also been made available to international organizations involved in the reconstruction in Lebanon. Mike is going to talk about some of the efforts to combat this threat and the evolutionary nature of the threat, and then talk about some of our conclusions. We see that there are a lot of signs of success, and we can talk about those in the questions and answers. In a nutshell, I think that as we move forward on this and almost every one of our other national security threats, it's safe to say that the incoming administration is going to be more, not less, interested in the non-kinetic tool set. They're going to be more, not less, interested in what this outgoing administration started talking about a year ago, so maybe too late, but it's now on the books, an all elements of national power strategy, and one that recognizes that a strategy means seeing what all your tools are and using them together to further one along. Each one helps the other. And that means that the non-kinetic tool set, that does not to replace the kinetic tool set, but is going to play more, not less of a role. And I hope that the recommendations we have might help that become reality.